Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
We would like to thank Jackson Physician Search, AAPL's Executive Alliance Partner, for their generous support of today's podcast. Jackson Physician Search is an established industry leader in physician recruitment and pioneered recruitment methodologies standard in the industry today. The firm specializes in permanent recruitment of physician executives, physicians, and advanced practice providers for hospitals, health systems, academic medical centers, and medical groups across the United States. For more information, visit www.jacksonphysicianssearch.com. Throughout much of the past, physicians were botanists. Medicinal gardens were the forefathers of big pharma. But not all things sprouting from the soil have been favorably received. For years, cannabis and psilocybin have been treated as contraband and not as medicinal agents. Today, we will discuss the understudied medicinal benefits of some illegal substances. Next, on Sound Practice. My guest today is Jeffrey Lieberman. Dr. Lieberman is a nationally known psychiatrist and neurobiologist. He is a best-selling author. His latest book is Malady of the Mind, Schizophrenia and the Path to Prevention. Dr. Lieberman, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thanks very much. Glad to be with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've been looking forward to our discussion. We're going to be talking about some mind-bending medications in substances, and I thought maybe you could give us a little context to frame our discussion.
Right. Well, mind-bending is the kind of colloquial term that's used, but it really refers to what I would call recreational intoxicants, and these are psychoactive substances that have somehow found their effects have been found to be pleasurable, and they're used for enjoyment in the same way that maybe alcohol is, or nicotine or caffeine are, but their effects are more powerful potentially, and also more controversial, as well as, you know, depending on when in time you're looking at it, illegal to varying degrees. So these are substances which have been used potentially variably for therapeutic purposes, but really the broader motivation to, I think, make them more widely available, ostensibly through demonstrating what therapeutic benefits they have, is because the public wants them. And the challenge for government in terms of policy, the law enforcement and judicial system, and the medical community, the scientific community, is to determine what are their risks and benefits. And that's what we're trying to do. The only problem is we're accumulating knowledge on what their mechanisms of action are, what they're really effective for, as opposed to the hype of what claims are being made of how they're beneficial, while the train's leaving the station, meaning they're being widely used for various purposes before there's any given proven evidence, and huge amounts of money are being invested and made as a result of it. So we have a convergence of sort of motives and interests that are driving this process. And I think what I try and do, and what the medical community is trying to do, is to be the responsible adults in the social or societal room in informing people about what the real truth of these substances are in terms of whether their risks and benefits are. And it begins really with cannabis, but just to describe the menu of these substances, I would consider the recreational intoxicants that are currently in play to be the cannabis products, the ketamine or dissociative pharmacologic substances, which would include fenciclidine, angel dust, or ibogaine. The psychedelics, the classical psychedelics being things like psilocybin, mescaline, LSD, ayahuasca, DMT, and then MDMA, or otherwise known as ecstasy. And unfortunately, there's a lack of rigorous classification or categorization of these things by many of the proponents of the use of these substances, which doesn't pay attention strictly to the pharmacology. So if you go on the website of probably the most influential foundation that's been promoting the development and legalization or therapeutic demonstration of their uses, MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, led by Rick Doblin, who I would, I don't know if he'll consider this an insult or a compliment, a latter-day Timothy Leary type. They'll consider all these things psychedelics, when they're not. Psychedelics are much more precisely defined. So these substances were historically used either ritualistically by indigenous peoples, or they were used by certain segments of society that were kind of avant-garde, on the cutting edge, bohemians, artists, musicians, etc. But then in the 60s, the counterculture broadened their use, and that's when the government had to come into action and set down boundaries of what could be used or what couldn't be used and what was legal or illegal. They did so in a way that was somewhat draconian, because some of these substances had genuine therapeutic potential, which had been really unexplored. And here I'm referring particularly to the psychedelic drugs. But it was throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It put such strict restrictions on it that there was really no research activity done for about 30 years or more. But then in the 2000s, there was efforts to try and reintroduce, for the purposes of at least exploring them scientifically for therapeutic use, if not also making them more broadly accessible by decriminalization and then legalization, which began. And from that point on, it was game on, and momentum built. The ways in which they were being commercially developed and marketed increased. The amount of money that flowed into investing in companies and commercializing them increased, and the ways that they were being promulgated and utilized increased. And this was really driven by the desire of the population, and the population asking for better access, better standardization of quality, rather than going out and buying it on the black market from your local drug dealer. This influenced state legislatures and has resulted in the decriminalization and many, I think that's up to like 38 or 40 now, the legalization of it in 38 or 40 states, at least of cannabis products. But the same process is following suit with the other types of substances, and particularly the psychedelics.
Well, let's start with the psychedelics, and probably front and center in my mind there, we're seeing, at least as far as legalization, is psilocybin. From a medical standpoint, what can you tell us about psilocybin's promise to treat certain mental health disorders?
Well, I'm going to start with a kind of an ironic question. This is, why psilocybin? Okay, so psychedelics are a very specific type of psychoactive substance, whether it's naturally occurring like psilocybin does in mushrooms, or whether it's synthesized such as LSD was. But they all have a common pharmacology. They act by binding to the serotonin 2A receptor and acting as a partial agonist. And they create a clinical effect, which approximates an altered state of consciousness that has mystical properties that many people find extremely illuminating, inspiring, and exciting and enjoyable. They're time limited. They vary from 2 to 4 hours to 8 to 10 hours in duration. And there are some differences in the subjective or qualitative nature of the experience between the various psychedelics, mescaline, psilocybin, LSD, the active ingredient within ayahuasca, DMT, but they're basically producing a similar kind of overall altered state of consciousness with some variation in the nature of that experience, more cerebral, more sensory perceptual, more powerful, more tractable. Now, these drugs are unique. I mean, there's no other drug in the pharmacopoeia that really comes close to producing the same kind of effects, even though, as I said previously, the classification by some advocates is not very precise and includes things like ketamine or ecstasy into this group, which it shouldn't be, which they shouldn't be. And it, understandably has suggested to scientists and physicians, and particularly to psychiatrists, that this unique effect that they have could be put to therapeutic purposes. And that's exactly what was being done in the 1950s and 60s before they were made so restricted by the DEA and the government that research all but stopped completely. Since they've been rehabilitated and pursued by a variety of companies seeking an FDA approval for some therapeutic indication, there's been sort of a return to research investigation, but it's not been of the most rigorous type, and it's not been the way that treatments for other types of ailments are developed. It's to put it in somewhat derisive terms, it's the amateur hour. And the tells in that regard are twofold. One is that no big pharma company is touching it. These are smaller companies that have sprung up by largely true believers who were well-intended, but scientifically naive, somewhat naive, as was Timothy Leary, you could say. And the other is that, and there's an article that I could share with you that was published about 3 years ago, where the authors did a search on NIH Reporter, which lists all the funded, sponsored research by the NIH. And there wasn't one study in psychedelics that was being funded. So it meant that it hadn't penetrated the academic medical research community. Now there are some, but not nearly enough. And so you have this process of trying to develop evidence to get FDA indication for specific uses that's ongoing and getting close to the finish line, but it's still with a modicum of the requisite level of basic knowledge about the mechanism of action, how these drugs work, what indications, what ailments are they actually genuinely and definitively effective for. And also, and this gets back to my opening question, why psilocybin? There's nothing which provides a rationale for why you would be nominating one psychedelic versus another to be used for any given condition, whether it's depression, whether it's addiction, whether it's anxiety. So there's no comparative effectiveness knowledge or data. So what I would say is that we're at a, I call it a Promethean moment. So as you see, students or people who remember their Greek classics know Prometheus was a human who angered the gods by bringing fire to humans and made it available, you know, prematurely and without restriction. And it turned out to be good and bad. It's good because we cook and eat food, but it's bad because it also makes weapons. And so he was punished for it. So we're at a Promethean moment. This could be something of tremendous value therapeutically, and not just for treating illnesses. It could be a rite of passage. There's books like Aldous Huxley's who've written about, you know, how this, and this is how it's used by the Native American church. It's used, so being a good Jewish boy, I became a doctor, but I also had a bar mitzvah. You know, so in certain Native American Indian societies, they utilize psychedelics as a rite of passage to initiate youth into adulthood. So it could be good for humankind. But the way we're going about it, as I've been intimating, is worrisome because it's not being done in as rigorous a way as I would like. And we're getting close to the finish line where a couple of the early entrants into the FDA approval process are getting close to being reviewed by the FDA and an advisory group, probably sometime in 2024.
We saw, starting back in 2019, this effort to decriminalize psilocybin. I believe it started in Denver, Colorado, but then other cities, Oakland, Seattle, Washington, D.C. And now we have states that have decriminalized it, Oregon, Colorado.
More than decriminalized, legalized it.
Yeah. From a public policy perspective, is this a good idea or really a dangerous trend?
Oh, I think it's probably more the latter than the former. It's one thing to have marijuana widely available. That's another thing to have psychedelics widely available. The argument for cannabis, even before people started touting its therapeutic properties, which is largely illusory. I mean, there's only one FDA approved indication for cannabis derived products, and that's a rare form of epilepsy. Everything else is mostly anecdotal or apocryphal. So its main cannabis derived products are mainly available for people to use recreationally. And that's not bad. I mean, it's hard to make a case that smoking pot or using pot is more dangerous than alcohol or tobacco is. On the other hand, that's for people at my age, you know, who are middle-aged or older. But there are vulnerable periods of life where the risks are much higher, and that happens to be youth, meaning adolescence and young adulthood. And what's happening is that with the legalization of cannabis and the commercialization of cannabis, the THC concentration has gone from when I was in college and we would smoke. Of course, we didn't inhale, but the naturally grown cannabis had THC concentrations of 2 to maximally 10%, Maui, Waui, Vietnamese, et cetera. Now that it's been commercialized, you can get oils, you can get gummies, you can get smokable forms. The THC concentration is upwards of 80%. And what we're seeing is many more casualties in the emergency rooms of people who are acutely intoxicated, but even worse, in individuals that smoke beginning at an early age, chronically, meaning daily, for some years, they induce a enduring state of psychosis. So these are not completely risk-free, and the group that's most susceptible to the harmful effects are adolescents and adults. In terms of psychedelics, what's happened is that the enthusiasm for them has gotten people to sort of say, well, if they produce these amazing kind of unique effects that give me a kind of perspective and experience and way of sort of understanding my life in the world. It must be good for something. And therefore, even before the data are in from the FDA testing process, there's facilities that are being established and financed to be essentially resorts or spas or clinics for people to have guided experiences. And Oregon, I think, has been in the lead by having legalized it, and money has been invested in establishing, you know, kind of a Canyon Ranch type facility for having a guided psychedelic experience. And then the term guided psychedelic experience is a little bit laughable, because sure, you can have somebody with you who is ostensibly a therapist that has some kind of experience, being able to work with people who want to have an intoxicated trip. But there's no standardized methodology. It's being basically improvised. And the improvised methods may be okay, but that's not the way medicine should work. There needs to be a standardized methodology that's applied uniformly after it's been validated as being helpful. This is a situation where the train's leaving the station while people are still getting on board, and the destination is still unknown. But the belief in the utility of it and the lack of sufficient dangers or risks is being ignored.
It does seem to be a dangerous trend, and I'm wondering if it is not restricted just to the substances we're talking about today, Dr. Lieberman, but has there been an impact from the pandemic and from COVID on the overall public's view and stance on these medications and on the field of medicine in general?
That's a very good question. I hadn't really thought about it in that way, but I'm sure that there is, because I mean the trend I think had been ongoing. You know, we saw this with autism and the vaxxers or the anti-vaxxers, but there's more of a skepticism on the part of the public of science and mainstream medicine that has emerged in the context of COVID, either because of the isolation people were forced into, or because of the fact that COVID was a brand new infectious pathogen that kept eluding medical science's ability to identify what mutated forms it would take, and developed iterative types of vaccines that were ostensibly going to be effective, but then weren't entirely effective. We saw the same thing with AIDS and HIV, but the skepticism didn't arise there in the way it is now. So I think you're right. The public coming out of COVID, or at least the initiation, worst part of the pandemic, has made people less willing to accept what they're being told by the medical community and empirically validated evidence about illness treatments that this research community provides, and more willing to accept either their own beliefs or what they hear on the internet or on irresponsible pundits on the media that are putting out false information. There's an erosion of the process of accumulating knowledge, vetting the knowledge, and making that part of the canon of what Western civilization believes. For thousands of years has gone through a rigorous vetting process to establish. And that's worrisome.
You alluded to it I believe earlier, but as you know, there are ketamine clinics popping up, I believe ostensibly to treat anxiety. Can you give me your thoughts on these clinics? Are they safe for patients?
It's really shameful and it's a black mark on I think the medical profession, how this has become promiscuously offered to people for many more purposes than the evidence has demonstrated, and I think what it reflects is the tension. So when you go to medical school, you're supposedly going into a noble, helping profession, and you take a Hippocratic oath, and you're supposed to have fidelity to the principles of that and the well-being of the patient. Of course, you got to make a living, no margin, no mission, but the tension between profitability and your sacred responsibility to first do no harm and try and promote health and an individual's relief suffering, that clearly should be the take precedence. But sometimes that balance doesn't, is violated. And ketamine is a good example. Ketamine is a substance. So the origins of ketamine occurred back in the 1960s when a pharmaceutical company in the Midwest was trying to develop a new treatment for, I think, postpartum hemorrhaging. And they came up with fencyclidine. And it wasn't for that. It was for, they were trying to develop an anesthetic that didn't produce sedating effects, which could, if given in too high a dose, as unfortunately Michael Jackson found out, cause respiratory depression and death. So this was a different kind of anesthetic that didn't work based on sedation. And they came up with the dissociative anesthetic. And the first one was fencyclidine, and it worked by binding to one of the glutamate ionotropic receptors. But fencyclidine caused a lot of adverse psychotoxicity, meaning people who were going to undergo some surgical procedure went crazy, and that wasn't going to work. So they produced a kinder, gentler kind of fencyclidine, ketamine. And ketamine became a dissociative anesthetic, meaning that didn't put you to sleep, but it put you into a kind of a dissociated state of mind so that you were kind of inured to the discomfort you might be experiencing. And it was used particularly, it became to be used particularly for children and for burn victims. So it was, just sort of a go-to anesthetic, but then it became a club drug because some people found the effects of it desirable, and it was used in that way. But it was then tested in depression, and this was kind of a Hail Mary type of an experiment. There was no a priori rationale of why it would be effective, but it was tested in treatment-resistant depression, and lo and behold, it had dramatic beneficial effect. And moreover, instead of taking 7 to 14 days like traditional antidepressants do to alleviate the symptoms, it did so very rapidly. So that was a good thing and could be used in severe depression and people who are suicidal. But psychiatry, which apart from ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, had no procedures. And procedures are among the more lucrative ways in which therapeutics can be administered as opposed to prescriptions for medications. Lo and behold, psychiatry had a procedure that was less invasive and controversial than ECT. And so the use of it in ketamine clinics began to proliferate. But it wasn't just psychiatrists. I mean, any doctor could do this, and anesthesiologists knew how to do it best, so they could get into this business, but it wasn't limited to anesthesiologists or psychiatrists. So you had a proliferation of clinics. You had more types of specialty doctors getting into it. And then they began using it for a variety of purposes beyond what it was originally tested in, severe depression or depression with suicide. The other thing that happened was that the original data showed how it could be administered acutely and produce a therapeutic effect. But the research had not yet been done to determine what's the optimal dosing, what is the best route of administration, does it need to be repeated? If so, how many times? And then what do you do for maintenance treatment? So you had all these questions about the original way in which it was administered, which is the way it's done in anesthesia, is parenterally, intravenously, by infusion. You can give a bolus or you can infuse it over a period of time. But people began giving it in those ways at different doses. They began giving it intramuscularly, and that wasn't good. And then the other thing that happened was that since ketamine had been an anesthetic for a long time, it wasn't patent protected. So using ketamine, even if there may be use patents for using it for psychiatric purposes, wasn't sufficient. So the desire by pharma to get some exclusivity so they could be able to generate more of a revenue was to find a more practical way to administer it. And that's when Johnson & Johnson got into lyophilizing it in the form of an inhalant form. But where the action really has been, that has not been a terribly successful drug in terms of the market share. What's been, I think, really promiscuously overdone is the number of clinics that have sprung up and the way people are administering ketamine, which in and of itself is not, it's generic, but the clinics themselves are big sources of revenue for the ways it's being used. And what was the actor's name from Friends that died recently? In Los Angeles? You know, that's a prime example of the risks. Now, that was an extreme example, meaning his death due to the combination of drugs he was taking with ketamine. But the other thing that's worrisome to someone like myself, who is very knowledgeable on psychopharmacology and neurobiology, is with the psychedelic drugs like LSD and psilocybin, et cetera, they can be psychologically dangerous for some people, but medically, you can't hurt yourself with them. You can take tons of it, and it's not going to hurt you for the most part. In fact, there's a built-in tachyphylaxis if you try and use it repeatedly within too short a period of time. With ketamine, though, and with the way it works on the NMDA receptor of the glutamate system, you can produce excitotoxicity if it's used in too high a dose or on a repeated basis, which can have produce organic brain injury. So we don't know what the cumulative effects of it are in people who may resort to using it for their psychologic symptoms repeatedly. So this is a good example of a drug that has psychoactive properties. Legitimate therapeutic use was found for it. Before the optimal way to utilize it and what other purposes it could be put to were determined, it already became, as common as CVS or Duane Reade or Walgreens on every street corner. There's clinics all over the place, and they're offering it to people in a very unrestricted way.
I'd like to end our time together with a discussion of cannabis. As a kid that grew up hearing Nancy Reagan tell the country to just say no, I'm amazed at where we are today. 38 states have legalized cannabis for medical use, while another 24 now permit recreational use. From your position as a psychiatrist, how's this working out?
I think that the way in which cannabis has been legalized and commercialized is not something I would say is horrific. On the other hand, though, the risks, what the initial sort of incentives or motivations to do it and what the risks are to society by having made it available in the way that it is really not optimal, meaning that, as I said previously, it's hard to say when, well, just going back to the original way in which society viewed cannabis, which was through the lens of an exaggerated dramatization of its evil powers in such things as the documentary Reefer Madness, that was vastly overblown and inaccurate. Because if you say, well, what is the basis for saying that cannabis is any more dangerous than alcohol or tobacco, which are legal, you can't say it's worse, because these things have caused untold degree of illness and suffering and cost. But by legalizing cannabis, allowing it to be commercialized, it's led to the production of a different animal than was the form of that cannabis was used in historically and during the counterculture in the 60s and 70s, meaning that when the public indicated its desire to have a broader access and used these ruses or these claims such as therapeutic properties as justification, that state governments saw one yielding to public opinion as a way of generating a product that would produce tax revenues. And the business community saw a new industry that could be created. Tobacco was on the wane because of understandable concerns and all the warnings about health risks. But cannabis industry overnight sprang up. Billions of dollars were poured into it. And in the 38 states where it's legal, you can find more forms in which cannabis products are offered than ever existed before. And moreover, the concentration of the psychoactive. So cannabis is a naturally occurring plant, which has over 100 biochemical constituents, but only two of them have any psychoactive properties. The main one being THC, tetrahydrocannabinol. So tetrahydrocannabinol in these commercialized forms, as opposed to the naturally grown forms, has multiples of THC concentrations, 80% versus, you know, maximally 10%. And the degree of intoxication is much more. And that's led to two consequences that are already apparent. One is that if you drive when you're drunk, you know, your risk for an accident is greater. If you drive when you're, you know, stoned on one of these more potent forms of cannabis, the accident rate in Colorado, which was one of the first to legalize it, has gone up. But the more worrisome thing for me as a doctor and psychiatrist is we are seeing in the emergency rooms a lot of people coming in with paranoid psychoses that have occurred while they're either intoxicated with cannabis, but even more seriously, people use cannabis repeatedly over long periods of time, talking about daily or multiple times a week for years. They can induce what is basically an enduring psychotic disorder characterized by paranoid perceptions and beliefs and delusions. And this, I call this a phenocopy of a naturally occurring form of a psychotic disorder. Phenocopy is not as responsive to treatment as idiopathic psychotic disorders. And This is going to increase. It's already been demonstrated in terms of data. And then the last thing I'll say is that, as you know, many medical conditions are polygenic, complex medical disorders. So type 2 diabetes, essential hypertension, atherosclerotic heart disease, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. In other words, these are not monogenic conditions. These are conditions that you have multiple genes contributing susceptibility in an additive fashion. And when you have a polygenic disorder, you have a risk score, a genetic risk score of what your chances of getting it. It's not certain, but it's possible or probable. But let's say you've got, you know, predisposition to type 2 diabetes, but you're an athlete, you watch your weight, you are very strict about your diet, you may never get diabetes. If you're a food critic or a chef, and you know, your chances of getting are much more. So the same thing, if you have a predisposition to a mental disorder and your lifestyle is such that you know, because of your risk, your genetic risk is not that great, you might never get it. But if you use some pharmacologic provocative agents like cannabis, it'll trigger it. So the end result of from both of these, phenocopy as well as pharmacologic triggers, is that the incidence, the population frequency of psychotic disorders is going to increase.
On that sobering note, thank you. My guest has been Jeffrey Lieberman. Dr. Lieberman is author of Malady of the Mind, Schizophrenia and the Path to Prevention, which is released in paperback in April of 2024. Dr. Lieberman, thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
Enjoyed the discussion. Loved and happy to talk about this topic.
My thanks to Jeff Lieberman for his time and insights. He brought facts and science to what could have been a polarizing political topic. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpracticepodcast.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpracticepodcast.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org.
That man Robin. Ripple Kapow.